I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
This is the result, as you can see, of many, many years, as you may not know, of Caballero's work. It's a book that's been unwritten many more times than it was written, you say at the beginning. And it's had many of those unwritten incarnations that go back a good way. In fact, I sort of got the impression that it might have been your first book at one point. You know, as you say, as a child, this is a story you always meant to tell. And then suddenly it was a story that he was absolutely not going to tell. And even within the book, you are definitely not going to tell the story. And then here it is. So can you tell us a little bit about the ghosts of this?
Well, first of all, I would like to tell a tiny story, if you let me, that my editor and publisher, Bill Swinson, knows by heart, because I always tell the story here, when I come here. The first time, I don't know if you know it, the first time Roman Jakobson, the great Russian linguist, went to Harvard, he was welcomed by the president of the university, who told him, "Mr. Jakobson, somebody told, I've been told that you speak 14 languages." And Jakobson said, "Yes, it's true, but I speak all of them in Russian." So I speak English, but I as well as Italian and other languages. But they speak in Spanish. Anyway. And, well, yes. This is the first book I wanted to write. Why? Because for me to write a novel is to formulate a complex question in the most possible complex way. That's to write a novel. And not to answer it. Or, I mean, you cannot answer the question in a very, in a taxative and equivocal clear way. You must answer it, if you answer it, in an ambiguous, equivocal, polyhedric, ironical way, right? In fact, the answer is it's the quest for an answer. So the question itself, the book itself. Anyway, and the first serious question I asked myself had to do, as I think this is general, I'm a normal guy, so this is general, has to do with my family, with my, my family. I live in Barcelona, but I come from a tiny village in Extremadura, close to the Portuguese border. And
called Iba Hernando.
Iba Hernando, exactly. It's a poor zone of Spain. But in the 30s and 20s was really poor, really. And the hero of my family was the main character of this book, or apparently the main character of this book, was a young boy called Manuel Mena, was the uncle of my mother. And, you know, was my family were the rich people in this tiny town. Mm. I mean, the rich people that when they went out of the town, were poor, of course, because the little town, the two classes were of people that could eat a bit, and the people that almost couldn't eat. That was the difference, you know, the social difference in this place. And my family could eat happily, right? And this boy was the first person in this little village that could go to the university. Almost the first, of course, of the family. And he was a sort of young intellectual or something like that. And when the war started, 1936, he became a an idealist. You know, he went to, he enrolled in Franco's army. He was a, he became a phalangist. Phalangism was the, you know, the version, the Spanish, Hispanic version of fascism, with all its nuances and things like that, but the Spanish version of fascism. And he went to the war, he enrolled in a, he became an official, he went to the, he enrolled in a, in a, in an elite unit, and he was in the worst battles of the war, Teruel, Lerida, which is not a famous battle, but it was a very important battle, and at the end he died in combat, in the worst battle of the war, well, in fact, the worst battle of the Spanish history, which is La Batalla del Ebro, almost at the end of the war. And he became the official hero of my family. And my for my mother, which is in fact the secret protagonist of this book, was the hero, the total hero. Of course, she was 5 years when the war began, 7 years when this guy, when this young boy died. He went to the war with, he was 17 years old, he was a kid. Mm. And when he died, my mother was 7, and for her was more than an uncle, was a almost a brother, because she lived with him. And for her was, you know, the great guy, the, you know, the prince that went to the war, the hero that went to the war to save the family, to save the homeland, to save religion, etc.
So just to make clear, we're talking about the Spanish Civil War here, not the Second World War. Yeah.
Yeah. So my family, my mother talked to me all the time about this boy. Mm. And, you know, for me it was a permanent presence, because I asked myself all the time why my family was on the wrong side of the history, right?
But wait, let's roll back. When, at what point did you know that was the wrong side?
That's a good question. When, and not, I mean, when I was a kid, I thought that the Franco side was the good guys were there. And but really soon, maybe when I was 10 or something like that, I became aware that I was wrong, and that my family had been in the wrong side, and that this guy was on the wrong side. And this was a story that was important for me, because, you know, I went to Catalonia as many people in the south of Spain in the 60s, but I keep coming back to this little town. And I knew that my family had been important there. That it was still important. That my in this little town, and as in many little towns in Spain during the war, happened awful things, terrible things, killings. And I didn't know what my family had done. I knew that my family was important. My, for instance, my grandfather, which is one of the main characters in the book, was the leader of the Falangist party in the little town. I knew after that, in fact, when I was finishing the book, that he had been also the first major of this town, but I didn't know what had happened. And I was scared to know. There is a character in the book, of course, after that, all my family was Frankist, but after that, all my family is a leftist. We are all, which is logical. And there's this character, which is one of my cousins. He was in politics for a long time in the Spanish Parliament and in the European Parliament. And he asked me at a certain point, when I told him that I wanted to write the book on this hero of the family and on the Frankist past of the family, he asked me, "Are you sure you want to know?" Which was a good question, because he says something that is very, I mean, it's common sense. Maybe you're going to find things that are not beautiful. What are you going to do if you find these kind of things? Are you going to tell these things? Or what about your mother? What is going to happen with this? So yes, this is the book I wanted to write from the beginning. And it was a difficult book. In fact, for me, that's why it's the most important book I've published. Because it's the book that I wanted to publish from the beginning, to write from the beginning.
Oh, can you say more about what was stopping you and what you found, what allowed you to do it now? I mean, that's the story, sort of, but then what is the...
I was scared.
Right.
It's very simple. I was scared. To begin with, I didn't know if it was possible to write the book. Then I thought I was stupid, and I thought, well, still I am, but anyway. I thought that it was possible to not to deal with my own past. I mean, it was possible to say, I don't have anything to do with this. Mm-hmm. I don't care about what my family did. I don't care about my past. I don't care about my heritage, my bad heritage. Mm-hmm. We all have a good heritage and a bad heritage, right? All of them, personally and collectively. That's obvious, right? And we don't know more or less what to do with the good heritage. But what about the bad heritage? What do we do with that? For us Spanish people, the worst heritage is obviously the war, you know, a terrible war, and which didn't last 3 years, as the books said. It lasted 43 years because of obviously the dictatorship was the extension of the war by other means. I mean, the war in fact didn't finish in 39, but in, I don't know, 75 when Franco died, 78 with the constitution, in my opinion, 23rd February 1981, when the last classical coup d'etat happened in Spain. Anyway, what we do with that? We conceal it, we edulcorate it, we invent another past to, you know, to a better past, as you know, my last book deal with a guy who invented, was called Enrique Marco, who invented, you know, a romantic, epic, melodramatic, wonderful past to conceal his real past.
The imposter, this is, yeah.
Yeah, the imposter. You know, he invented everything. What we do with that? Or we look at it. And my answer is that it's better to look at it. I mean, finally, you should do it. It's better to, first of all, to know it in all its complexity, and then to understand it. Mm. And to understand is not to justify. It's exactly the contrary. It's giving you the instruments not to repeat the same mistakes. So, finally understood that. I understood that it was compulsory. It was necessary to first know and then understand. To know is very difficult. To know the past of your own family is very difficult, especially if your family, as all families, have been in difficult circumstances, like the war, for instance. Mm-hmm. Because our families, I mean, there's a fog.
Yeah.
Right? On our bad heritage. Mm. People that have been, I'm looking to my, because yesterday we were talking about that with my publisher and my editor, people that have been in very difficult circumstances, a war and things like that, don't want to talk about that. And it's logical. And they have the right to shut up, to be silent. But I think that we must know. We have the obligation to know. Because, why? Because if you know your past, your bad heritage, but especially your bad heritage, and you understand it, you can control it. If you don't know it and you don't understand it, it is this past that governs you. And then you keep repeating all the time the same mistakes, which is, by the way, what's happening today, not in Spain, not to me, to everybody around, you know, in Occident, we are repeating obviously the same mistakes that we did in the 30s, right?
Yeah, well, obviously.
There's this sentence, by Bernard Shaw, that says, the only thing that we learn from experience is that we don't learn anything from experience. So we keep repeating once the same mistakes.
That's very good, very clear. I mean, it's also a book full of unanswerable questions, which is part of something, it's part of what you have to deal with. I mean, there are things that you want to know and can't know, and there are other things that are actively masked. I mean, you know, documents that are questionable, stories that people don't want to tell or haven't told before. But I suppose one of the things that we were talking about earlier is the question of whether it's a book about the past, really. I mean, so you talk about your bad heritage or good heritage, but actually it's not just the heritage that's in view.
Okay. This is not only in the case of...
Put it over.
Because
Sarah,
I need
Hall.
My hands.
Yeah.
I hate when people say that I write historical novels. I don't like it. Because I don't write historical novels. I write novels about the present. But about the special present, let's say it. I mean, I think, Gavi, that we live in a sort of dictatorship of the present. Yeah, but not in Spain, everywhere. I mean, this is due, in my opinion, to the overwhelming power of the media. I mean, for the media, you are a journalist. Present.
I'm the dictator.
Yeah, the present. No, the media have, you know, wonderful things, but they have side effects. And for the media, today, present is not today, but now. And what happened this morning, well, it's almost... And what happened last week, it's past. And what happened a year ago is like prehistory or something like that. And this creates a false view of reality. Mm. And for people, you know, history is something that is in bookstores and in the archives. And there's freakies like myself who are interested in it. But it's not relevant for the present, right? Mm. And this is, in my opinion, this creates a completely false vision of reality, because past, and especially the past of which there is still memory and witnesses, this past is not, I mean, this past is a dimension of the present without which the present is mutilated. I mean, there is this sentence by Follner, in Requiem for an Nun, by Follner, which is a leitmotif of the imposter, that says, past is not dead. It's a wonderful sentence. Past is not dead, it's not even past.
Yeah.
And I agree. I mean, and what I mean, half of this book is set in the present to begin with. And then what this book does is to try to show, and not only this book, I think that my books from Soldiers On are a sort of humble battle against this dictatorship of the present. Mm-hmm. I mean, they try to show that this past is here working on us, right? That the Spanish present doesn't begin today, not in 1975, but in 1936. Mm-hmm. That's the beginning of the present. And this is everywhere, because the present in this country doesn't begin today or with the arrival of this guy. You have this American guy here, or you know, it's in 39 or 40, right? So that's for me very obvious. In fact, Soldiers of Salamis, which is a book linked to this one, very obviously. I mean,
we'll
for me,
this, that,
this book is like it's like the end of the of Soldiers of Salamis, and it will be the end of something, because I'm going to reinvent myself in my next book. I hope so. This is the end. This book is the end.
You're done with the Spanish Civil War.
It is impossible to be done with the Spanish Civil War, because it's the beginning of the present.
What's at the end of then?
What?
What's the end of? This is the end of what?
This is the end of something that began in Soldiers of Salamis. I mean, Soldiers of Salamis, you can describe this book, which has a lot of...
Yes, we're coming to... Yeah, well, no, but let's... Yeah, keep going.
I mean, you could say that Soldiers of Salamis was... You can read this book as a sort of vindication of the Republican past, right? Which is the past that I think we should... I mean, it's a... The democratic past in Spain, right?
Can we tell the story of that briefly? For those of you who haven't read Soldiers of Salamis, it's about a man who was not shot, who escaped the firing squad. He becomes the hero because, you know, he's survived. But in fact, the real hero is the person who found him in the forest and let him go. So the person who saved him, who is invisible, is in fact a Republican. And the person who becomes a hero is a nationalist. And then, so that's very good. But this is a fiction. And this sort of counterpart, the current counterpart, Lord of All the Dead, is, well, in fact, a character in the book, David Trueba, the filmmaker who made a film of Soldiers of Salamis, says, oh, I see, so you invented a pretty fiction to cover up your, you know, whatever he says, ugly past. So the true ugly past, which is now coming as a sort of secondary chapter, was, in a way, I suppose, well, he's suggesting the reason why a kind of pretty cover had to be made.
Yeah.
In Soldiers of Salamis. But anyway, I'm just sort of trying to illustrate the sort of the twinning of these two books. But go on.
Yes. No, it's like that. I mean, you describe it perfectly.
Keep going.
But you can read the Soldiers of Salamis as a vindication of this good inheritance, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, this is an assumption of the bad heritage. That's why these books are like that. But yeah, in Soldiers of Salamis began something which was special. I mean, before Soldiers of Salamis, I wanted to be a postmodern writer or something like that. I would say a postmodern American writer. Then I went.
Which one? Which one did you want to be?
You know, Donald Barthelme, Robert Coover, this kind of guys. Then I went to live to the States for 2 years, and I made a great discovery. The discovery was that I was Spanish. I began to sleep siesta, to talk, you know, out loud, how, and to, you know, eat at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Anyway, and so this began something different, which was, in many respects, the past was present in these books. In my previous books, was not present. Politics, for instance. Mm. So this, you can summarize this book saying that it is about a guy of my generation, I was 39 when I wrote this book, that thinks as my generation thought at that moment. It is incredible, it's like that. We're talking about 2001, that the Civil War was, you know, as remote and alien to us as the Battle of Salamis. We were fed up with all that. I mean, we wanted to be, yes, postmodern, Tarantino, Almodovar, blah, 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 you know, normal European guys, whatever it means. And the Civil War was old, awful, and this guy of my generation, called, by the way, Javier Cercas, he, by chance, he's a journalist, and he investigates this tiny episode, forgotten episode of the Spanish Civil War, and finally, he discovers that past is present. That past is a dimension of the present with which the present is mutilated. Mm-hmm. That in that past that he thought that was completely irrelevant for the present, he finds there the sense of his own life. Mm-hmm. Right? So this was the beginning of this taking the past into the present, and this was the beginning of many things, of novels without fiction and blah 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 blah. But now with this book, I'm finished with this. I want to begin another life as a writer.
Now you're going to be Robert Coover.
No, I'd love to, but no, it's impossible.
Well, we can talk about what's next in a minute, but I want to ask you, you raised that question of form, which is very interesting, and the question of whether this is non-fiction or fiction, or what a non-fiction novel might be and what it might be in your hands. But Javier Cercas, the character in Soldiers of Salamis, who is a fictional character, and played by a woman, in fact, in the film. Here, there's also a character called Javier Cercas, who is referred to in the third person with his full name when he investigates things or when he's told things. How is he different from the character in Soldiers?
Completely different. I mean, in these books, from Soldiers to this one, almost all the main characters are called Javier Cercas. But they are all completely different. I mean, the Javier Cercas, yes, completely different. I mean, the Javier Cercas of Soldiers of Salamis was completely invented, yes. And this one is really close to myself, because this is almost a non-fiction novel. It's not exactly a non-fiction novel. The Anatomy of a Woman was a non-fiction novel. The Impostor was a non-fiction novel. This one is not exactly a non-fiction novel. Why? Let me tell you. I think that. To write a novel, I told you, formulate a question in a complex question in the most complex possible way. But as every question is different, the way to formulate the question must be different in every novel, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like creating a game to write a novel for me, right? The writer should discover the rules of this new game, and the reader, while he writes the book, and the reader should discover these rules while he reads the book. Mm-hmm. But every rule is different. Every book has different rules. In this case, yes, because if you have two books with the same rules, one of them is bad book, for sure. and in this case, it's a special, the rules are special. I mean, in fact, there are two narrators in the book. One of them is it's a like a public notary, right? Like a historian, a classic historian, a very, very traditional historian, doesn't want to invent anything. He's a stick to the facts and to the documents. He discusses the documents. He wants to, you know, be very precise and very, almost not interpret anything, just to tell the story of Manuel Mena, the main character, and my family, and my little town in the 20s and 30s, I always remember this sentence by Tolstoy, a wonderful sentence. He says, picture your village and then you will picture the world, right? Through the tiny village, you can, that's the idea, to tell the story of the Spain in the 20s and 30s through this microcosmos.
Mm-hmm.
You can put it like that. Anyway, and this historian despises, you know, the literature. This historian wants to, okay. And then on the other side, you have what I would call the process of the novel, right? Mm-hmm. I sometimes say that I write adventure novels on the adventure of writing novels, because and this is very general in this, from soldiers on. On the one side, on the one hand, you have a story of the recent past, and then the process of telling the story. So my doubts, my perplexities, or the doubts and perplexities of the narrator, you know, how he investigates this past, how, etc., etc. I remember recently reading a letter by Italo Calvino, which was one of my heroes when I was wanted to be a postmodern writer, but still I love him. And he says in a letter to a friend, there are some books, there are some books in which showing the process of the book itself is almost a moral obligation, which means also an aesthetic obligation, because in literature, moral and aesthetic is the same thing, right? It's both. So, and this second narrator, it's called Javier Cercas, right? Mm-hmm. This guy that shows the process of the novel. And he's more free. I mean, here, for instance, it is very important, the humor in this part of the book, you know. And here, I invent a bit. Just, let's say...
Thanks for letting us know.
Yeah, let's say 2%. But it's not important. I mean, I don't invent... I stick to the facts and to history in the history part, but I invent something. And I think that the reader feels it. I mean, it's not inventing. I mean, for example, I invent some conversation. But you remember the discussion on Velázquez and Goya about the war? That's not that didn't exactly happen like that in that moment. But it is 2%. It's 2%. The point, Gabby, is that...
I've lost all faith in you now, that's it.
The point is that in a true story, in a non-fiction novel, if with 2%, everything becomes fiction. I mean, it's like in a glass of water, you put a bit of poison and you cannot drink it. So in my opinion, this is not exactly, I mean, we can discuss on that, but in my opinion, this is not exactly a non-fiction novel, because okay. I take some liberties, some.
It's more fictional than a non-fiction novel would allow itself to be.
Yeah, because the anatomy of a moment, for instance, is just...
pure fact, yeah. Yeah, but you're still calling it a novel, so I suppose I wonder if you're quite on board with that idea of why it would be described as a novel if it's non-fiction. But we're getting kind of... Well, do you have an answer to...
Oh, yeah, it's very... I mean... Yes, of course. I mean, it's not so difficult. Yeah, theoretically, I remember Forster's definition of novel, right? And she says it's a fiction or blah, blah, blah. It's a fiction. So we accept that novel is a fiction. But my question is, why should the novel be a fiction? Why?
Why is a non-fiction a novel?
Because there was this guy called Miguel de Cervantes, that incredibly was a Spanish guy, and he invented this thing called novel, and the first rule, he gave us a rule, the first rule, he gave us this incredible instrument that has created modernity. Without novel, there's no modernity, in my opinion, and I'm very serious with that, and he gave us this instrument and said, in this new genre, there are no rules. Or the first rule of this genre is that there are no rules. So you can do whatever you want. And this was a complete revolution. Because, you know, before, of course, I mean, in the classical tradition, the genres, the literary genres have their, from Aristotle on, their, you know, their rules. But here, no, you can do whatever you want. Which means that it's more difficult, because every book needs to find its own rules.
So the thing you were describing.
I finish. In this book, in The Anatomy of a Moment, which is in fact my first non-fiction novel, Soldiers of Salamis is a false non-fiction novel.
Yeah.
It is. The narrator says it is a non-fiction novel, but we must not trust.
He's unreliable,
the narrator.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, Cervantes said that he didn't invent the story of Don Quixote. It was an Arabic guy called Fite Amete Mendengeli, but it's not true. He invented that. He cheated on that. Okay. So in The Anatomy of a Moment, which is my first non-fiction novel, I was working for 3 years in our Kennedy's assassination, right? Which is the 23rd February 1981. It's the last coup d'etat in Spain. Classic coup d'etat in Spain. You remember these guys entering the parliament, the civil guards entering the parliament and shooting. You've seen the images, they are incredible, wonderful, extraordinary, but the greatest document, historical document, in my opinion, of the 20th century in Spain. Okay, so I was working on that for 3 years, you know, talking to hundreds of people and reading hundreds of books, blah, 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 and trying to write a novel, meaning a fiction, right? Pure fiction doesn't exist. When we talk about fiction, we talk about a mixture of fiction and reality. Pure fiction is a fiction. It doesn't exist. Never exists. I mean, from Homer now, the literature is like that. Anyway, and I discovered that I was wrong, that I couldn't go on with that. This was a bad choice to write a fiction on another fiction, because the 23rd of February, as Kennedy's assassination, is one of the biggest fiction in Spain. I mean, it is a bunch of lies and of half-truths and crazy theories and etc. And the proof is that all Spanish people have a theory on the coup d'etat. I mean, what is a Spanish guy or a Spanish woman? A woman or a guy that has a theory on the 23rd February 1981. I'm looking to Eduardo Mendoza, probably the greatest Spanish novelist alive. He's here, and it is like that. I mean, everybody has a theory on that. As what is an American guy, a guy that has a theory on Kennedy's assassination, of course.
That's what. That's how they give you citizenship.
It's the exact point, where all the demons of the Spanish past converge. Anyway, I decided at that point when I thought that the 23rd of February was a fiction, was an enormous fiction, a collective fiction, that it was ridiculous. It was redundant, it was literally irrelevant to write a fiction on another fiction. And so I decided to write a novel, a book with the form of a novel, mm-hmm. you know, with the faith in the form of a novel and a novelist, but without this fiction. And that's the book. It's the same with the imposter. I mean, with the imposter, I was dealing with a walking fiction. Mm-hmm. This guy mm-hmm. was a walking fiction. He invented everything about his life. Mario Vargas Llosa said that he was the greatest imposter in history, and I agree. He's the Messi of the imposter. And so it was ridiculous. It was again redundant, literally irrelevant to write a fiction on this guy. And what I organized in the book was a sort of battle between fiction and fact, or between fantasy and reality. And I insist, why not? Why not write? No, if you need, what Cervantes said is, do whatever you need, right? And mm-hmm. I try to do what Cervantes asked me to do. I try to be very disciplined and very.
So in the sort of looser parts of this book, there's a scene, actually very early on, where the character Javier Cercas is talking to David Trueba, who is the filmmaker, who'd made the film of Soldiers of Salamis, and he says, don't do this, you know, what are you thinking? And he exactly spells out, although possibly in a fictional conversation, the controversy that's going to erupt as a result of writing this book. And then they both go on this kind of semi-road trip and decide that they're on board, you and Trueba, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, can you briefly evoke what you imagined the controversy was going to be and whether it's been met with that in Spain as a result?
No, David was right, as always. He's very intelligent. He's a wonderful writer also, and he was right. I mean, when you write about one of these subjects in Spain, the book, if the book is not controversial, it is not, cannot be a good book. It is impossible. I mean, I think so. I mean, in this book, we're dealing with a fascist, young fascist, that it is a person, a complex person. And this is very difficult, apparently, to accept for lots of people. Look, we prefer lies than truths. We have here the proof, the walking proof, today in London.
We've welcomed him with open arms, yeah, exactly.
He's the greatest liar in the world, and people like lies. I mean, it's like that. And when we deal with the worst past, we prefer... I mean, and Marco was a walking proof of that also. Marco was telling lies all the time about the Spanish past. Mm. You know, creating this heroic past, edulcorating the Franquism, you know, saying that, no, there were just a few Franquists in Spain and
yeah,
the other
sweetening
were,
it, yeah.
Yeah, Democrats and things like that. And we were all anti-Franquist and etc., which was completely false.
But here were you accused of being an apologist for the Falangists? I mean, is that...
Because they... Yes. I expected that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I mean, it's logical because, first of all, I think that... Okay, I was remembering something. I was friends at the end of his life with Todorov, Tsvetan Todorov, because he was very interesting. He was very generous with the imposter and, well, anyway. And we met sometimes in Paris. And one day we were discussing on one thing, because yeah, I was talking to him about this book, the problems of the book, this book, blah, blah, blah. And he told me something that is very interesting. It is difficult to think about a book, European book, Occidental book, after the war, whose main character is a fascist, and it is not a monster. It is not a monster. Okay, you can think of Lucien Lacombe.
Lacombe
Lucien, the Louis Malle. But he is a monster. He's a burglar, but not here, I mean, not because we have exactly given a simplified version of the past. I mean, fascism was very attractive. Lots of people, a thousand of people around the world were fascinated by it. Mm. It was fashion. It was, if you read the speech by José Antonio Primo de Rivera, that probably this poor Manuel Mena, 17 years old, heard, I'm almost sure, because he lived close to the place where José Antonio in Cáceres gave the speech. If you read that, José Antonio was talking about, you know, fascism, Falangism was anti-capitalist, anti-system, was, you know, revolution, was... Mm. Fascists didn't go with horns with in the street. No, they were, you know. And now we give this vision of... It was very attractive. I mean, Hitler was very attractive for a lot of people.
Yeah,
right?
Well, he revoked all the reasons why people would have followed them, yeah.
And if you say that, you become suspect. Mm. And you become suspect because some people don't understand the difference between understanding and justifying. I mean, what literature does, according to me, and that's why I'm not anymore a postmodern writer. When I was a postmodern writer, I thought that literature was not useful, that literature, you know, it was a game, and that literature just that, and it was not useful. I was completely against the idea of politics and literature and, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre and all this bullshit. Now I'm sure that literature is useful, as long as it doesn't want to be useful. Because if it wants to be useful, it becomes propaganda or pedagogy, and then it stops being useful. But if literature wants to understand everything, it then becomes useful. I mean, it's not enough. I mean, to understand, which is what great literature, according to me, does, is exactly the contrary of to justify, is to give you the instrument to not, so you don't make the same mistakes as your ancestors. I mean, if some genius, let's say Shakespeare, Cervantes, Dostoevsky, one of them, could make us understand. I mean, it's not enough for a novelist to say that Hitler was a bad guy. We all know that. I mean, that Hitler was an assassin. Okay, we know that. The kids know that. The question that a novelist, a genius, would formulate in the most complex possible way would be why this awful guy, fascinated, and his bunch of, you know, guys around him, fascinated not only Germany, one of the most civilized countries in the world, but half of the world. Mm. That's the question. And if Sam Dostoevsky or Sam Cervantes or Sam could formulate this question in the most complex possible way and show us why, then I'm not saying that Hitler wouldn't repeat, but we would have some instruments so that this would be more difficult. It's the same. I finished, Gabi. It's like there's a bomb here. Imagine there's a bomb in this wonderful library. It's not enough to say, oh, there is a bomb. It should be here. Should call some
Dostoevsky
people so that he can, how you call that? The guy who knows, who understands, and deactivate the bomb. Understands the bomb. A guy who understands the bomb and then deactivates the bomb. And that's what real thinking and real literature does. Can give us instruments so that we understand. But people don't like that. I mean, it's fair to say, if you don't say all fascists were bad guys, you are just justifying fascism. And that's a big mistake. That explains, in my opinion, why we are repeating the same mistakes that we did in the 30s, which is obvious, right?
So you're deactivating the bomb, or the readers are deactivating
the
bomb.
Dostoevsky.
Well, this bomb, this small bomb here in your family, what should we take from that, if anything? I mean, I doubt you'll be prescriptive, but is there anything we should be taking from the book that will teach us something specific?
I don't have an answer to that. The answer is the book. I
mean, okay.
Yes. It's the best answer I can give to that, right? The most complex and answer I can give to that. So yeah. It's not possible to...
The answer is the question.
The answer is the question itself, exactly. It's the book itself, yeah. For an answer.
We should let you ask some complex questions if you'd like. Although there is also, if we have time, we were thinking Javier might read from the book in Spanish, in which case I can read the translation, but there's a really wonderful sentence at the end. Actually, it's a 3-page sentence, just to warn you. which gives a brilliant evocation of how the past is still with us, or how certain things never die. But let's see how many questions you have first. I think we'll leave that to the end.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
You appear in the last two books, as you mentioned already, and I'm not bothered about the sort of truth, the kind of fiction, non-fiction point. To discuss that, but I'm interested, just out of interest, to know when you're in the book, or the person with your name is in the book, is that you?
It is a mask that I put myself. I mean, it depends on the book. In this case, I mean, it is always a mask. Mask is what persona means in Latin, right? And the mask is something that conceals you, but also something that reveals you. Probably reveals you more than it conceals you. I mean, if I come here with a mask of a pirate, it says a lot about me, right? About my. So in every book is different. In Soldiers, it was a very different mask. Well, for many reasons, I could. And in this case, the mask is really close to me because I'm dealing with my family. I'm dealing with my personal heritage. to try to deal with the, I mean, what literature does is to, or try to do is to transform the particular into the universal. That's Aristotle, right? So that's what we try to do. Through my personal history, to tell the story that it's not only my story. And in every book is different, I insist. I mean, Soldis was very different from myself. The Impostor was close to myself. This is the closest, I would say. What I mean is that some of these masks are more real than myself. More myself. It's like the eye of the poet. When a poet says I, it's that himself. Something that he invented, some tool he invents to say something, right?
You've explored the past and the effects of the past on the present. There's a lot going on in Spain. I know you're teaching in Girona. I wondered if you want to kind of tell the stories of what's happening at the moment more directly, or if you think the best way to do that is to continue to explore a kind of a generational story.
What's happening in Catalonia, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, we're having
you
fun
knew that
here.
Question was coming up.
No, I can't. Right now, it is impossible for me. I mean, I write in a newspaper, and I write all the time about this thing because it's, you know, very important for me also personally. I must say that it is a turning point in my life. What happened in 2017? Everything has changed. My view of things, everything has changed. So it is very important, apart from obviously being the most important crisis in the Spanish democracy. But I as a Catalan, for me has been very important personally. But it would be impossible for me to write something like The Anatomy of a Moment, which is a book on a historical event, on a public event like that. It would be impossible to write a book like that about Catalonia, completely impossible. I feel myself today, I can write articles, but I cannot write a book like that. I feel that I am like, you remember, we all remember Fabrizio Del Dongo, the main character in, I don't know how you, in English, how is like
a leopard.
What?
The leopard.
No. The leopard.
No.
Oh, the Chartreuse House of Parma, yeah.
Chartreuse House. You remember the book, you remember that Fabrizio is like, it's a sort of Manuel Mena. It's a young boy, an idealist, that, you know, is in love with Napoleon, and at the beginning of the book he goes to Waterloo and he doesn't understand a word. He doesn't understand anything. He just sees horses and dust and cries, and Napoleon goes and he doesn't even recognize his hero, right? So he doesn't understand anything. I feel like that. I feel like the battle must stop. And then the dust settle, and then see, count the deaths and see what has, and then I could write. But I'm going to tell you something that I told my Bill Swainson, my publisher. I'm going to tell you something, which is I'm almost finished with a new book, which is completely different, I hope, from this one. I try to reinvent myself. I try to do something completely different, and I was really happy. It was a refuge for me when I was writing it, saying, "Oh, I'm not talking about this awful thing that is happening right now in Catalonia. I'm so happy, and I was there in my, you know, my studio writing and happy. And now I'm rereading the book, and I've seen that the subject of the book is what's happening in Catalonia. it is like that, but it is like a dream, right? You have a dream or a nightmare, and the nightmare is about you are in an abyss." On the verge of falling in the abyss, but in fact, you are, the subject is that you have problems with your wife or with your mother or whatever. It's the same thing, right? So that's my way right now of coping with this story.
So from the particular to the universal, why is Spain so unable to be accountable with its past?
Good question. Okay, when I was young, not necessarily postmodern now, I thought that my country was different from the other countries, that my country had real problems with its past, and the other countries were normal. They lived you know, happy lives without problems. Now, I know, I don't think, I know that this is not true. That all countries, including the oldest democracy in the world, has problems. And for us, Spanish people, this country was like, you know, civilization and, you know, democracy and culture. And, you know, we were Africans or something like that. But no, all countries have problems with their past, especially with their past, with their worst inheritance. The point is that our past, our worst past, is still very present. Why? Because I said it before, the war didn't finish as your war finished in 45, or German war. The German people had real problems with their past. All European countries have problems still today with their past. And the point is that our war didn't finish in 45 as German war, as the Second World War. The Spanish Civil War was the first act of this. You can read it like that. It's correct to read it like that. The prologue of the Second World War. But it didn't finish in 45. It finished in 75, something like that. So we are still dealing with it. I come from the Hay Festival where they asked me the same question. And I remember this. One of my favorite writers alive is a British writer, Kazuo Ishiguro. For me, it's great. It's one of the greatest novelist alive, and he deals with this problem in his last novels. His last novel, which is, in my opinion, by far the worst novel by Ishiguro. By far.
The Buried Giant.
Yes, The Buried Giant. He deals with this problem. And what he says is, it is better not to unbury the giant, which is the worst past. It is better not to unbury it. Because if you unbury it, then the war is over again. And I don't believe that. I believe that in the transition, so-called transition in Spain from the dictatorship to democracy, we, not only the political class, made a decision which was not to forget, it is completely true, false, to put aside the past, to say, okay, we're not going to use that as a political weapon, etc. To put aside it, and to look at the future, but the past was there, and everybody knew about that. And, you know, I can assure you, and as all Spanish people know, that the newspaper will full of stories about the war, books about the war, novels about the war, films about the war. So this story of the pact of forgetting is completely false. But to put aside the past, this is true. But at the end, it is like in a personal trauma. I mean, if I have... something happens to my family, something really bad, I don't want to, I need to put it aside, to go on. If it's really bad, I need to put it aside and say, okay, let's go on, let's look at the future, but I know that it's there. This is not to forget. This is something completely different. But at the end, in my opinion, you must look at it and to know with all the complexities and to understand. And we had the opportunity to do that, in my opinion. The opportunity was at the beginning of this century. Unfortunately, with a movement, I don't like the name, called Historical Memory, whatever. The Movement of Recovery of Historical Memory, I don't like the name. Anyway, it was a just movement. It was unbury the giant and to kill the giant. But something that was a necessity, something that was an urgency, generally felt in Spain, become in the Impostor, which is my most controversial book, especially in Spain. I call it the industry of memory. I mean, it became a fashion, and we didn't solve the problem, and we still have this problem. And it is not a problem of the past; it is a problem of the present. But all countries, we all have problems with that.
So that, I think that it would be good if Javier could read as he wrote it, and then I will read for those of you who don't speak Spanish, if that's okay, even though that means ending on me, which is not quite what we want. But
this is like explaining the end of Game of Thrones or something.
Oh yeah, you explain it and I'll find you the spot, yeah. Okay, here we go. Cortés sigue hablando.
Okay. One of the reasons I finally wrote this book, one of them, is that something that was a miracle happened, which was that I found the exact place where this hero of my mom had died. The exact place, meaning the exact room. Mm. And I went with my mom, which is, it says, the secret protagonist of the book, because she gave me the inheritance. And I found that. For me, it was a sort of miracle, because... Okay, so this happens in this place, which is a sort of palace in the middle of nowhere.
And who is Cortés? We have to explain also.
Oh, yes, Cortés is a wonderful guy. Anyway. It's a guy that helped me to find this place. He's the person that helped me to find this place. It's a wonderful character. And yes, he was my guide.
My guide, yeah. So,
Cortés seguía hablando. This happens, like, this is in the palace, right? Pero yo ya no lo escuchaba. Y poco a poco, la euforia y la sigilosa alegría en que me sentía levitar se convirtieron en otra cosa. O tal vez fui yo quien sintió que se estaba convirtiendo en otro, o que ya se había convertido en otro, una especie de viejo y mediocre y feliz Ulises a quien aquella expedición, por las tinieblas de aquel caserón vacío en busca del monarca de las sombras, which is the
title of the book, Mena,
acabara de revelarle el secreto más elemental y más oculto, más recóndito y más visible. Y es que no nos morimos. Que Manuel Mena no había muerto. Que mi padre no había muerto y que mi madre no iba a morir. Eso pensé de golpe, o más bien lo supe. Que no morirían mi mujer, ni mi hijo, ni mi sobrino Néstor, que tampoco yo moriría. Con un estremecimiento de vértigo, pensé que nadie se muere. Pensé que estamos hechos de materia. Y que la materia no se destruye ni se crea, solo se transforma. Y que no desaparecemos. Nos transformamos en nuestros descendientes como nuestros antepasados se transformaron en nosotros. Pensé que nuestros antepasados viven en nosotros como nosotros viviremos en nuestros descendientes. No es que vivan metafóricamente en nuestra volátil memoria, pensé. Viven físicamente en nuestra carne, en nuestra sangre y nuestros huesos. Heredamos sus moléculas y con sus moléculas heredamos cuanto fueron, nos guste o no, lo aborrezcamos o no, lo asumamos o no, nos hagamos cargo o no de ello. Somos nuestros antepasados como seremos nuestros descendientes, pensé. Y en ese momento me abrumó una certeza que no había sentido nunca. Ahora pienso que podía haberla sentido en cualquier otro momento, mejor que debería haberla sentido, o por lo menos intuido. Pero el hecho es que fui a sentirla por vez primera allí, en aquel antiguo quirófano de aquella mansión abandonada, de aquel pueblo perdido en la Tierra Alta. Junto a mi madre y mi mujer, y Cortés y Josepa Miró, sentí que estaba en la cima del tiempo, en la cumbre infinitesimal y fugacísima y portentosa y cotidiana de la historia, en el presente eterno. Con la legión incalculable de mis antepasados debajo de mí, integrados en mí, con toda su carne y su sangre y sus huesos convertidos en mis huesos, mi sangre y mi carne, con toda su vida pasada convertida en mi vida presente, haciéndome cargo de todos, convertido en todos, o más bien siendo todos, comprendí que escribir sobre Manuel Mena era escribir sobre mí, que su biografía era mi biografía, que sus errores y sus responsabilidades, y su culpa y su vergüenza, y su miseria y su muerte y sus derrotas, y su espanto, y su suciedad, y sus lágrimas, y su sacrificio, y su pasión, y su deshonor, eran los míos, porque yo era él, como era mi padre, como era mi madre, y mi padre, y mi abuelo Paco, y mi bisabuela Carolina, del mismo modo que era todos los antepasados que confluyen en mi presente, igual que una muchedumbre, o una legión innumerable de muertos, o una selva de fantasmas, igual que todas las sangres que desembocan en mi sangre, viniendo desde el pozo insondable de nuestra infinita ignorancia del pasado. Comprendí que contar, que asumir la historia de Manuel Mena era contar y asumir la historia de todos ellos. Que Manuel Mena vivía en mí como vivían en mí todos mis antepasados. Eso pensé también. Y al final, borracho de lucidez o de euforia o de sigilosa alegría, me dije que esa era la última y mejor razón para contar la historia de Manuel Mena. La razón definitiva. Si había que contar la historia de Manuel Mena era sobre todo, me dije, para desvelar el secreto que acababa de descubrir en el reino de las sombras, en la profunda oscuridad de aquel palacio olvidado y ruinoso donde empezó su leyenda y donde, entonces lo vi, como escrito en una radiante obra maestra nunca escrita, iba a acabar mi novela. Aquel secreto transparente según el cual, aunque sea verdad que la historia la escriben los vencedores y la gente cuenta leyendas y los literatos fantasean, ni siquiera la muerte es segura. Esto no se acaba, pensé, no se acaba nunca.
Beautiful, so lovely to hear that. I'll just read the translation, beautifully translated actually by Anne McLean. Is it McLean she pronounces it?
McLean,
yeah, sorry. Last week, Juan Gabriel Vázquez pronounced it Anne McLean, and I thought he had special information. But anyway, Anne McLean is the translator here. Cortés was still talking, but I wasn't hearing him anymore, and bit by bit, the euphoria and stealthy joy in which I'd felt myself lifted turned into something else. Or maybe it was me who felt he was turning into someone else, a sort of happy and mediocre and old Odysseus, to whom that expedition through the shadows of that big empty house in search of the Lord of all the dead had just revealed the most elemental and most hidden, most recondite and most visible secret, which is that we don't die, that Manuel Mena had not died. That's what I thought all of a sudden, or rather what I knew, that my wife and my son and my nephew Nestor would not die, and I would not die either. With a shiver of vertigo, I thought that nobody dies. I thought that we are made of matter, and that matter is not destroyed or created, it just transforms. And that we do not disappear, we transform into our descendants, just as our ancestors transformed into us. I thought that our ancestors live on in us as we will live on in our descendants. It's not that they live metaphorically in our volatile memories. I thought they live physically in our flesh and our blood and our bones. We inherit their molecules, and with their molecules, we inherit everything they were, whether we like it or not, despise it or not, accept it or not, whether we take it on or not, we are our ancestors as we will be our descendants, I thought. And at that moment, I was overwhelmed by a certainty I'd never felt. Now I think I could have felt it at any other moment, or better yet, that I should have felt it, or at least intuited it. But the fact is that when I felt it for the first time, I was in that former operating theatre, in that abandoned mansion of that village lost in the middle of Terra Alta, beside my mother and my wife and Cortés and José Pamiro. I felt that I was at the summit of time, on the infinitesimal and so fleeting and extraordinary and daily peak of history, in the eternal present, with the incalculable legion of my ancestors beneath me, integrated in me, with all their flesh and their blood and their bones turned into my bones and my blood and my flesh, with all their past life turned into my present life, taking them all on, converted into all of them, or rather being them all. I understood that writing about Manuel Mena was also writing about myself, that his biography was my biography, that his mistakes and his responsibilities and his guilt and his shame and his misery and his death and his defeats and his fear and his filth and his tears and his sacrifice and his passion and his dishonor were mine. Because I was him, as I was my mother and my father and my grandfather Paco and my great-grandmother Carolina, in the same way that all those ancestors who gathered in my present, just like a crowd or an innumerable legion of dead people or a forest of ghosts, just like all the bloods that flowed into my blood coming from the unfathomable well of our infinite ignorance of the past, I understood that telling, that accepting Manuel Mena's story was to tell and accept the story of all of them, that Manuel Mena would live on in me as all my ancestors lived in me. I thought that too. And in the end, drunk on lucidity, or on euphoria, or on stealthy joy, I told myself that this was the final and best reason to tell Manuel Mena's story, the definitive reason. If Manuel Mena's story had to be told, it was most of all, I said to myself, to reveal the secret I had just discovered in the realm of the shades, in the profound darkness of that forgotten ruined palace where his legend began, and where I saw it then as if written in a radiant, never-written masterpiece, I was going to finish my novel, that transparent secret according to which, although it might be true that history is written by the victors and people weave legends and writers fantasize, not even death is certain. This does not end, I thought. It never ends. Well, thank you. This does end. Thank you very much for being here, and please give Javier another round of applause for being here.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.